Greetings, everyone, and welcome to episode number 23 of Real Blend, a podcast that made more money than Solo over the weekend.
Hey!
My name is Sean O'Connell, and I am the managing editor over here at Cinema Blend, which helps explain why Real Blend airs live on CB's Facebook page. So if you are watching us right now, hello. If you're listening to us later, we hope that you are using iTunes or Google Play or Spotify or any of the methods used to download podcasts. So while you're at it, give us a star rating, write a quick review. All of those mentions that you guys do on the different podcast apps really help us out. Boost the status of the podcast, so we really appreciate it. And by we, I mean my amazing co-hosts, starting with the king of 70mm projection, Mr. Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. Kevin, how are you?
Good afternoon, Jonathan. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. We're going to get to your 70mm excursion later, and we're going to loop in our other co-host, Mr. Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago. Jake, say hi.
Hello, my handsome friends. How are you?
Oh, it's good to be back with you guys live and recorded, if you're listening to us later. We are going to get into Solo, a Star Wars Story spoilers today. We're going to talk box office, we're going to talk about the future of Star Wars, and we're going to talk about some things that don't have anything to do with Star Wars at all. So let us begin with news and kick right off with Solo, a Star Wars Story box office over the Memorial Day weekend. And I find this really interesting. We had a conversation recently when it came to Deadpool 2, and we all sort of hesitated to use a word, the word disappointing. Because Deadpool 2 opened below what the original opened to, and so we had set expectations. And now that we're talking about Solo's box office, because of the expectations of a Star Wars franchise, I'm going to put it to you guys. Is it fair to use the word disappointing when you talk about a movie, a Star Wars story, that opens less than $100 million for the 3-day and needed a fourth day to get to $100 million?
Oh, absolutely. Jake, I think so? Disappointing is a totally fair word to use. The word that I've been hearing that I'm not super comfortable with is bomb. Because mm-hmm. I don't know. And I sort of felt that way with Justice League too. Like, I have a hard time saying that any movie that crossed $100 million in 4 days is a bomb. I mean, I get it in relation to how much it cost. But bomb is a really ugly word that takes a lot less to do that.
The interesting thing for me, by the way, was the conversation we were having about Deadpool 2, and I remember Jake was posing that question in our chat about it being disappointing if it didn't open past its original film, and I argued against it, because, I mean, I thought $7 million less than the original film made was not a disappointment. I felt that it opened up in a more crowded marketplace, clearly with the Avengers Infinity War, and I'm in no way defending Deadpool 2 because I liked it more. I just don't consider that to be a disappointment whatsoever in regards to box office, considering the film is about to cross $500 million worldwide, hasn't even opened in China or Japan yet. It's going to do big numbers and have very good legs, like it already has. But yeah, I mean, like, it's interesting because then when you put the two films in comparison, which is an interesting thing to do in itself because they're completely different movies. One's PG-13, one's R-rated, so I look at those specific details as well. But yeah, I mean, this Solo, I mean, what did it do worldwide in like three? Was it 148, 150?
It was like, it was like one at 150, which is not a great worldwide opening either.
Yeah. I mean, I think, and the big question is why. And I think a lot of us can all agree here on reasons why we think Solo didn't open well. And I think, in my opinion, it comes down to one, May release, very crowded marketplace. You're in the middle of Avengers, Deadpool 2. That to me was just a poor choice of placement. I think they should have stayed in December. Two, there was a lot of bad news surrounding that movie. I mean, a lot of bad news surrounding it in regards to the directors leaving, things like that happening. The film itself was very, in my opinion, mediocre. I know Jake will say, Kevin, you're mediocre. But yeah, one of those things.
I got to start changing up my jokes if you can start calling them out before I even say them.
No, but I just think there was a lot of things going on with this movie. It was, and also, 5 months prior to that, a disappointing, to a lot of people, Star Wars film opened up in December. So there was a lot of things kind of going into it. Also, if you look at the jump in numbers, Force Awakens made $2 billion. The Last Jedi made $1.3 billion. That's right. A $700 million drop. Yeah. That's a massive, I mean, $1.3 billion is a lot of money, clearly. Right. Rogue One made a billion. Rogue One also did 155 domestically opening weekend, which was more than Solo did worldwide in 3 days, from what I understand. So it's interesting.
But when Force Awakens came out, we sort of treated Star Wars differently than we treat other movies, and it lived up to those expectations box office wise. And we did that because we so rarely got them. If we're going to start getting them once a year, and in some cases within 6 months of each other, we have to start, unfortunately, not putting them up on this pedestal anymore and treating them differently than we treat other films, and that they're just, some of them are just going to have okay box office, and that's sort of disappointing.
Well, but Last Jedi would have done Force Awakens numbers had it been as good, in my opinion.
No, I don't think the quality knocked off 700 million.
I do. I think
the quality knocked off almost $1 billion from the box office? No, Force Awakens was a phenomenon. Because Force Awakens was a phenomenon unlike anything we've ever seen.
It was the first one in so long to come out.
Bringing the cast back together, it was an anomaly.
But how much of that 700 million do you think was hurt by poor word of mouth? I mean, to be honest, The Last Jedi was a very anticipated movie, and it opened very close to Force Awakens.
I think people went back to Force Awakens more times than once.
Yeah, I agree.
I know I saw it in the theaters 3 times, and specifically I went to go see it on like IMAX screens and bring people. Because that was one of those movies where I wanted to experience it with people. I made you see it in
DC in 70mm IMAX. I think I went back and saw that thing 3 or 4 times. I didn't go back and see Last Jedi multiple times. So
is this a status of, like, not to keep comparing to the Marvel franchise, but like it's almost like the Marvel franchise is the bar to raise it to, right? Like, is it just we kind of expect them to always have an Avengers movie, and every once in a while they're going to have a Doctor Strange or an Ant-Man, right? Which, not to say the quality is bad, but they're not going to perform.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a perfect comparison. I don't think, you know, if we're going to start getting these cross-universe movies, and if there are characters that were introduced in Solo, they're going to pop up in, you know, the Kenobi movie or whatever the case may be, then Marvel is an apt comparison. And in that case, sometimes you're going to get an Avengers box office opening, and sometimes you're going to get an Ant-Man box office opening.
Yeah,
you can't expect it every single time.
But how do you explain one of the most beloved characters of all time getting their own movie and opening less than a film that had no famous Star Wars characters whatsoever in the leading format?
Because it wasn't like Harrison Ford, and I'd argue that it's just not the same.
But how did Rogue One open so good? Why did Rogue One open so well?
Because they had Darth Vader to promote with it.
And it was the first It was the first of the standalone movies.
Yeah,
so
we were still riding high off Force Awakens.
Yeah. Here's someone asked in the Facebook chat, people who are watching us on the Facebook Live, asked about the cost of Solo. And I read the numbers and I was stunned that this thing cost a reported $300 million. That does not look like a $300 million movie.
Well, because they reshot it.
Yeah.
So it's all the reshoots?
I think so.
Yeah. I mean, they basically made 2 movies. I mean, like if I'm not, if I could be wrong, but yeah. I read Lord and Miller shot close to 80% of the film.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's true. That's what I read.
Yeah.
Another number that I read was that there's about 30% of the footage still exists in the movie from what I've read. I don't know if that's true or not, but I know for sure that Ron Howard told me specifically there is footage of Lord Miller in his movie. And then Woody Harrelson said a lot of the train scene was already shot prior to Ron Howard stepping in. So, yeah, if you shoot 80% of a film and then you have to reshoot another 70% of it, right? Is that the case,
was Tanny Newton at the junket and like didn't really know Ron Howard?
That's possible.
How much of her stuff? Because
let's not get into spoilers yet. Let's not get into spoilers just yet. We'll get into spoilers.
Well, no, Tanny Newton's in more scenes than just the train scene.
We're getting a weird hand signal from Gabe, and I'm not quite sure what it means.
He means save it for later, I think. Save it for later because we're talking about spoilers.
Okay.
But you bring up an interesting point. Let's bring that back up when we get back into the spoiler territory. But that is pretty interesting.
I don't know if I want it anymore.
Let's get to the next news point because it's kind of part of this. On the heels of, or right in the middle of Solo dropping, Lucasfilm confirms a little bit of what their long-term plan is. Because we were saying this earlier on the podcast of like, I wish we just know what they were hoping to do next. And they confirm a Boba Fett movie.
Did they confirm it though?
Well, I don't think Lucasfilm has.
I think everyone's reporting it. But last I saw, Lucasfilm has said nothing about Boba Fett.
Way to derail the podcast, Jake.
I'm sorry. I think that's an interesting point, though. Were they holding off on confirming Boba Fett to sort of see what happened with Solo?
Right.
I thought the Boba Fett news dropping when it did was to increase the attention around Solo.
Right.
That's what
I mean, I could be wrong. And if you're watching at home, I mean, let us know if I'm missing some sort of confirmation from Lucasfilm. But I think as of this recording, they haven't.
The trades have reported it, but you're right. I haven't seen anything from Mangold. So James Mangold was announced as a writer-director of it. But there was no time frame given for this. Like, we only know episode 9 of December 2019. And beyond that, it is currently, right now, Rian Johnson trilogy, Benioff. Had David Benioff and D.B. Wise trilogy, and now this Boba Fett movie, with the rumored Obi-Wan movie also out there, and then Favreau's thing is going to streaming, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. But a lot of these could end up going to streaming and not be theatrical. We just don't know anything confirmed.
I have a hard time saying that they're going to spend $200 million on a movie and not send it to theaters.
Let me ask you guys a question.
Sure.
Episode 9 comes out next December. J.J. Mm-hmm. Abrams is back in the directing chair. Yes. A lot of faith in that filmmaker. Did a great job with The Force Awakens. Let's say the buzz around that movie is amazing. Does it make more money than The Last Jedi?
Potentially.
Yes.
Hard to say right now.
I think so too, because I think they're going to promote it in a way like they promoted Infinity War, which is like, this is the end. Like, your entire life,
you've been
watching this 9-chapter story. And now we're at chapter 9. I think they're going to, if they're smart, they will promote it as this, like come see it while you can. Because after this, my dog's getting very upset just talking about it.
Can I say one thing real fast with the Solo box office?
He's a Colin Trevorrow fan. Yeah.
No, I promise you she is not.
Just one quick thing. I don't want any movie to fail ever. And
agreed.
As I sit here and talk about Solo box office, I'm not happy about it. I mean, as a person who's a reviewer, as somebody who's interviewing actors in this business, I mean, you obviously want the business of movies to do well. I personally didn't love Solo as a critic. I thought it was just okay, and I recommended it mildly on a matinee scale. But yeah, I mean, I don't want people to like listen to this and go, oh, they're just, because there's so many people online right now that are very negative and very mean about people, about the box office, and people don't understand how much work goes into these films, how much work Ron Howard had to do to fix what was going on. And I'm not excusing the movies itself, because the movie itself, as a review, it stands in my review. But outside of that, I don't think anybody should take pleasure negative box office story. That's all.
I just want to mention this too. Like, what do the people who are down on, like, the conversation is Disney's killing Star Wars, right? Theoretically. And as wrong as I think that is, what do those people want? Like, do they think that Disney's going to sell Lucasfilm? Or do they want George Lucas to take it back over? Because none of those things are going to happen. So what are you rooting for?
The last time George Lucas took over Star Wars, or not took it over because he already had it, we got a really horrible diner shot in episode 2 with Obi-Wan sitting across from a creature that now I'd argue doesn't look good enough to be fit into a video game. Like, that's the Lucas movie. Like, I feel like now we're looking back at the prequels as like these works of genius that the great George Lucas gave us. And it's like, do you not remember how far we've come in just the last 15 years?
Right. And Jake and I have argued about this a lot over text, and I think him and I have come to an agreement now in regards to where we stand with the episodes. I mean, I don't hate 1, and I don't hate 3. 2 is arguably one of the greatest, worst movies of all time.
Agree 100%.
But 1 has scenes I like. Darth Maul, obviously the fight scene and the pod race.
And it's a great kids movie. I was 9 or 10 when it came out, and I thought it was fantastic.
Listen, it's not a great movie by any means, but it's not as bad as everyone says. And I'm not saying we need to go back to Lucas, because I could argue Lucas, I don't think Lucas is a great director, but I think he's a great storyteller and a great coming up with ideas type of guy. But I just, I mean, listen, Attack of the Clones is bottom of the barrel Star Wars, no question. Solo is nowhere near that.
And I hope it is always the bottom of the barrel. Like, the bar should be just to be above Attack of the Clones, really. Yeah. Just keep it above that.
I like that we didn't even tease what this week's game is going to be, but we are doing Star Wars Blend later in the show, where the three of us have chosen our top 3 Star Wars films. Because obviously picking the best, we'd come up with the same 2 answers, theoretically. But
yeah, I'm curious as to what it's, because the third slot is going to be I don't know what your picks are, but I'm assuming we all have the same first 2. So really, it's the third one is
Clone
is the
Wars,
argument.
Sith, and then we sort of debate what the third one is going
to
be.
I don't think I have the same first 2 as you guys.
You might not. Actually, when I asked Gabe what your choices were, he made a face that made my stomach turn a little bit.
Oh, God. What?
Yeah, so I'm curious. This is actually something a conclusion I've come to recently. So I'm excited to share it with you guys.
Oh, God.
So the conversation of Star Wars is dead and Disney's killing my Star Wars and fire Kathy Kennedy, like all this stuff is hilarious because then we CinemaBlend was able to go down to Orlando and take part in Galactic Nights and learn something about Galaxy's Edge, the new Star Wars theme park. And all of a sudden everyone's like, ooh, tell me more. Like, I want to hear more about this Star Wars land. So not so dead, exactly. But have you guys paid attention to any of the stuff that's been revealed? It sounds incredible.
I mean, it's going to be, I saw the drone footage they released of, that was in Disneyland, right?
Yeah. World. Hollywood Studios.
Oh, okay.
No, there are two of them. One is in Disneyland, yes.
I mean, it looks amazing. I mean, I'm super excited about it, clearly. And listen, people can sit here all day long and complain about Star Wars. People are still going to go to the theater and see it. I just think when it all comes down to it, I think there needs to be a little bit less of playing it safe, but which is weird because Rian Johnson didn't play it normally safe as, you know, as a Star Wars film would be, and people didn't love it. So I think that, to me, Solo is a very safe Star Wars movie, but what would Lord of Miller's movie have looked like? I have no idea. So I don't know. There's so many ways to look at that perspective, but I think people need to get off the idea of being black and white about negativity in regards to Star Wars. Like, you know, just find a middle ground and like what you like and dislike what you dislike, but don't crush the whole Star Wars universe because you didn't like one movie. You know what I mean?
Jake, a friend of mine who's a diehard Star Wars fan, as much of a diehard fan as you are, is debating between, and I'm going to put this to you, if you had the chance to only go to Celebration in Chicago, so it's hard, it's right there for you, or Galaxy's Edge, which one would you prioritize?
I mean, I honestly sort of, here's what I'll say about Celebration. I flew to Orlando last year. And I went to all 4 days, and by day 2.5, there was a little bit of like, this is a lot of Star Wars. And I love Star Wars, yeah. And there was a lot. I went to the 40th anniversary panel. I went to the Episode 8 panel. But it's just a lot. I'd argue if you went to Galaxy's Edge in the same way that if you went to Comic-Con, at least you can get your Star Wars fix and then go off and do a little something else if you want to hop over to one of the parks and get your Jurassic Park fix, or if you want to go to the Wizarding World of Harry Potter. You know, you can kind of do that. And granted, if you come to Chicago, you can go to Star Wars Celebration, and then you can come hang out at my place. I have a very comfortable fold-out couch. But it's... I do. I don't know if you've never heard this, but it's Star Wars Celebration is a lot.
Yeah, but the thing about it is... The thing about it is Galaxy's Edge is going to be there now for a long time. Celebration has the element of if you're not there when it's taking place, you're missing something.
And that's very true. So it also depends on like how important the big movie of the moment is. So obviously this upcoming Star Wars Celebration, it's going to be all about Episode 9. And I think, like I said, talking about sort of the end of a chapter of Star Wars before we move on to these other people's trilogies. So there is a special significance to that. And once you miss it, you can't get it back.
Also, so you want to get to meet the directors. You want to meet the directors of the new franchises before they get fired. Right. So that's important.
And if you want to meet the third guy that works craft services on Attack of the Clones, this is your spot, baby. You get in line, and 4 hours later, you get to meet him.
And pay to have your photo taken with him.
Damn right.
Let's get out of Star Wars for a minute. Right as we were getting ready to record a podcast, we heard news that Jamie Foxx was cast as Spawn. And will be directed by Todd McFarlane. Are you guys excited about this? I don't know a lot about Spawn. I know the first movie is terrible.
I dig it.
I enjoyed the first movie, actually. Was that Michael... the heck was the gentleman's name who played Spawn?
I know what you're talking about.
Leguizamo. John Leguizamo.
John Leguizamo was the clown.
Right.
He was
Michael...
Rooker?
He was also in Black Dynamite, right? The gentleman who played Spawn. What the heck is
Michael...
his name?
Michael...
Hold on. Hold on.
All right, we'll figure it out. But Tom McFarlane directing the spinoff is awesome. First of all, he directed arguably one of the greatest videos of all time, music video-wise.
Michael Jai White, someone just
said. Oh,
okay. Well done. Well done.
And Michael Jai White was also in Black Dynamite, right? I believe it was him, and he was in Spawn. He's a great actor. I'm just trying to remember if I have the name right. But the Tom McFarlane directed Freak on a Leash, which was a great video by Korn.
Did he really?
Which I'm super... Yeah, it was like a really cool music video with a bullet going through the video. It was like total Todd McFarlane animation. It was so well done.
That's cool. That's awesome.
And it's a Blumhouse picture, right? So it's not like he's seeing any crossover in any other universes. Or does he even exist in other universes?
I don't think he does. I think he's his own thing. I don't know. I'm excited to see what they do with him. It has the potential to potentially do a... It has the potential to potentially... Try to do that again.
Have you guys seen Black Dynamite?
No.
Oh my god. It's like one of my favorite... Dude, Black Dynamite is legitimately an amazing movie. You gotta watch it. I mean,
What is it about?
It's like a very like 70s exploitation. You just have to watch it. Like Michael Jai White is so good in it. Just watch it. Trust me, it's amazing.
Okay. It's awesome. Talking about amazing films that you guys were able to see, and if you don't live in one of the four cities where this slice of magic happened, because I'm one of them, and I got to sit back and watch the text chain go through, the boys went to go see 2001 A Space Odyssey in 70mm. Kevin, you're pretty up to date on how this came together, because your boy Nolan is involved, so why don't you just catch people up with how this even started, because I didn't realize until you just put it on social today that this is from Kubrick's actual camera negative?
Yeah, oh yeah, it's the original, it's from the actual camera negative, it's the unrestored version of the movie, and Gabe saw it as well, he can back me up if I have any information wrong here, but it is truly just a experience that I never thought I'd be able to have. I know Jake had it as well. Nolan saw this movie, from what I've read in interviews, with his dad, and I think if I have it correct, I believe when Star Wars was released in 77, they re-released 2001 after Star Wars came out because of the success of that movie, just the idea of space, I believe. And I could, you know, don't quote me on that, but
sounds about right.
Jake, did you read the story about Nolan seeing the film with his dad after seeing Star Wars, and they re-released 2001?
No, I don't know that story.
I believe they re-released 2001. He went and saw it, and in my mind, that was kind of the spark that led to the genius of what Nolan became nowadays. I mean, if you watch Dunkirk and Inception and Interstellar, there is so much Kubrick in those movies, and especially rewatching 2001 in a 70mm theater with that much sound. I truly kind of got a great appreciation for the art of what Nolan has done throughout his career. If you look at something like Dunkirk, which is heavily led by music, very minimal dialogue, very, very minimal exposition, that's exactly what 2001 is. I mean, there's dialogue clearly, especially in the second act, in the middle of the film, but a lot of that movie is just solely music, sound effects, and just that leading your storyline. On top of that, the idea of in-camera practical effects. I mean, back then, Cooper didn't have the ability to use CG, so you do everything in camera, essentially. And that's kind of where the Inception hallway came from. They built a hallway that spun with the camera in place while Gordon Levitt did his fight scene. They removed the wires, and it looks unbelievable. So, to me, it was a very full circle moment for me as a film lover to sit in a theater and watch the film that, in my opinion, sparked the genius of one of the greatest directors in the history of filmmaking, and just kind of like unraveling that in my mind. Oh, this is where he got this and this and this and this, because it's been so long since I've seen the film. The 70mm aspect of it, there's nothing like it. I saw Phantom Thread in that format. This is non-IMAX, this is just 70mm projection, and it is glorious. The sound is amazing. The print is just bubbling with grain and like beauty. It looks fantastic on camera.
Part of the reason why they can't show it? Like, why is it only four? This is my complaint about it. Is that why is it only four theaters?
Well, they're bringing it. They're platforming it. So I think, that's a good question. I don't know specifically why the prints are so limited, but I will say, is there a major market for this other than massive film nerds? You know what I mean?
I don't
foresee this being put into 4,000 theaters and like, you know, and again, I'm not knocking anybody who's not massively into films, but like, I feel like this is a very small audience that's going to see this movie. I don't know.
Outgrow Solo.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, but I mean, hey. It truly is one of the greatest experiences I've ever had. And Nolan had a great quote in the interview he did with Entertainment Weekly, which I thought was precisely on the point of what this movie is. It's like Kubrick essentially folded space and time, and the movie just kind of exists now, right, as it did in 68. So to me, there's something to be said about when you sit in the theater and you watch this film, specifically the last act, and the whole sequence with Hal going crazy, and that whole moment outside the spaceship, to the essentially the thing that happens in Interstellar with Matthew McConaughey is very similar to what happens to the characters. He's going through that massive field of whatever that was until he ends up in that room, and he sees himself at different ages and the baby. I mean, it's very, I don't know. To me, it was just a very unique experience to be able to have that experience and see the film on the unrestored version from the negative that Kubrick shot on. So
which famous director did you almost watch the movie with?
I want to get to Jake too, because Jake saw it in Chicago.
I did not almost see it with him. Unfortunately, I was the most famous person in the movie theater, so your story's better.
It's still pretty famous.
I didn't see him, so I rolled to the theater, and like an idiot, I'm like, I'm more interested in getting a picture outside. I'm like framing myself and getting the 70mm. Meanwhile, apparently Steven Spielberg was leaving the theater, and I had no idea. I don't know if it happened as I pulled up, but the concession gentleman at my theater, this is the theater in New York. It was called like Village City Cinema or something like that. And Spielberg had just gone to the 10 a.m. show, and I went to the 1:10. Now, I was in interviews for Ocean's 8 at the time, so that's why I didn't watch it with Spielberg. So it's Sandra Bullock's fault. I genuinely apparently missed him by 10 minutes. Like the concession guy said, he was there, he came up, he bought, reportedly from another concession version, he said he bought a small popcorn and a small soda, and he watched 2001 Space Odyssey.
Before I get to Jake, and Jake, I promise, plenty of time. I just want to know, if you had walked into the theater and Spielberg were there,
you
wouldn't have gone up to him?
No, I would
he
not.
He knows you, though. You have
he knows
to.
You actually could have sat with him.
Yeah.
Here's why. What I would have done if I'd noticed him, I'll tell you a funny story, actually, about the guy who introduced the movie and retracted one of his jokes when he noticed Spielberg was in the audience.
That's very funny.
So if I had seen Spielberg, if I walked in, I saw Spielberg sitting there, I would have freaked the hell out. I would have probably would have walked out, texted you guys immediately. I wouldn't have said anything to him until the end of the movie because I wouldn't want to sit there with him knowing that I was there in regards to like him worrying if I was going to look over to him and go, hey, this is cool, isn't it? Or like bother him. I didn't want to.
Which is exactly what Kevin does in movies.
What I would have done, yeah. But so I would, I mean, in my dream state of mind, the movie would have ended or intermission would have happened and I would have been like, hey, man. we'll say what's up to him and then left. But apparently here's what happened. So there's a guy that came out at the beginning of the movie that introduced the projection. He was the projectionist. And he made some terrible joke about that we were about to watch a 70mm unrestored print of The Royal Wedding. It was awful. But it was like undeniably cheesy and it was funny at the time. So I talked to the concession guy.
That's pretty great.
I think that's funny.
I think that's pretty great. Yeah.
But the concession guy was telling me that when the projectionist walked in to introduce the Spielberg showing, the 10 a.m. show, apparently he looked over and saw Spielberg in the audience and did not do the Royal Wedding joke because he was too nervous about it.
Aww.
So he took the joke out and then just kind of said, enjoy 2001, whatever it was. I wasn't there, but that's what the concession person told me. He said,
imagine being Spielberg and you don't even get to hear good jokes.
I know.
He loves corny even jokes.
I just can't imagine. Like to me, it's surreal to imagine Spielberg just, here's what that moment did for me. And I'm sorry, I'm like overtaking this part, but, to me, that just shows you, like, we are on a, look at our level, all right? We are fans of movies, but our generation is fans of people like Spielberg, Nolan, Tarantino, yeah. Coppola, whatever it is, right? Then you have Spielbergs and the Nolans of the world who are just like us in regards to fandom of films they love, and then they have that same nerd-out passion that we do about those filmmakers, right? Right. So Spielberg, Like as crazy as that is in our mindset of how big of a deal Steven Spielberg is, he was just us walking into that theater watching 2001.
Yeah.
That's crazy to me about that guy just being a fan of Kubrick and just watching his movie. And then years later, he works with the guy, and then he puts a Shining scene in his Ready Player One movie. I mean, it's very cool and kind of put things into a weird perspective for me.
It's a cool year for Kubrick fans. Before getting to relive, the Shining sequence, and which I not only say I forgot about, but I didn't even think about that connection.
Jake, before I get your review, I just want to mention that one of our listeners, Kalina,
Kalina.
I'm not sure if I'm probably pronouncing that wrong. Her boss is letting her work in her boss's office so that she can watch this podcast while she works.
And she's actually a very vocal fan of our podcast. She tweets us often.
I think that's great. Give her a promotion. A raise and a promotion.
Hey, Kalina.
Massive race.
Yes.
Massive race.
Jake, you said this was like one of the most exciting things that you've ever experienced. And so the way you couched it is you've been able to travel the world and see a number of really amazing things. And I think partially you're doing this just to rub it in because I was not able to go see it this
weekend. Yeah, I absolutely hated it, but I just wanted you to just to be jealous.
Well, I admire that.
No, I mean, actually, I often
go ahead, what did you think of it?
You know, when we talk about Star Wars or Jaws or something like The Exorcist, I always I always regret that I wasn't alive to have experienced those in theaters. Not just see them on the big screen. I'm not talking because these days you can see just about anything on the big screen if you live in the right city and can find the right prints. I'm talking about being a part of like a cultural movement, being a part of like a moment that people talk about 25 years. I've seen Jaws on the big screen, but I can't talk about what it was like that summer that it came out and everyone stayed out of the water. They played 2001 at a theater in Chicago called the Music Box. Not only am I partial to it because it's a great theater, it's also where I happen to have gotten engaged. So it's, you know, it's old school movie theater, kind of, you know, not stadium seating, you know, so that very much like the sort of movie theater that people used to wear suit and ties to go to. And there was a line out the door of people waiting to get in. And so I stood in line and I got my popcorn. And then I went to this old movie theater, and to Kevin's point, like the reel had like scratches on it, and it had like, you know, had that grain that Kevin talks about, the chemical
cigarette
life,
burns,
had the cigarette burns that I learned about from Tyler Durden. And so there was just this moment where like, I'll never know what it was like to watch it back in 1968, but I feel like that's as close as I'll ever get without actually getting there. And
Jake, you saw exactly what people saw in 1968. Like, there's no question. No, you literally saw the exact print and movie. Yeah. I mean, not the exact print, but the exact negative of what Kubrick shot and put out in 68. So you actually experienced literally the exact thing people experienced in 68.
And the cool thing was, too, there was a father a couple of rows over that had brought his young daughter. And it was I was eavesdropping, and it was her first time seeing it. And he was kind of preparing her a little bit in the sense that, like, this is not your traditional film. There's not a traditional what you would think of as a plot. Just kind of go with it. Think about what this was like 50 years ago. And she seemed, it wasn't like she was rolling her eyes. I'm like, okay, whatever, Dad. She seemed super into it. And it was a nice sort of refreshing reminder that like new film fans are born every day. And I think younger generations get a knock for like not appreciating older cinema. And it was just like, you know what? Like that's not right. Because like here is one right here.
Do you think more filmmakers, because Nolan is putting more 70mm projections, and I know that that's preventing people from going down that route. Is it just the cost of the film? Like, is it going to prevent? Is Tarantino still going to do experiments? Is Nolan going to keep pushing the 70mm? Or is this these one-offs that we just have to appreciate when they come around?
But these guys are having success with the format. So it's not as if money's being wasted. Like, for example, something like a Dunkirk or a Dark Knight or an Interstellar, and then Tarantino. Now, Hateful Eight, I think, don't quote me, was probably not his best box office. I don't think it did anywhere near like Django numbers or things like that. That was a tougher sell movie, not because of the format, but just because it was. I don't know. Hateful Eight wasn't as easily accessible to me, to audiences, as something like Django was or Inglourious Bastards. And I can double check on those numbers, but I don't think it did as well. But I think, you know, the idea that the greatest filmmakers of our time are still choosing to shoot this way and push things out in a format of film projection or shooting on film. And like people always say to me, oh, digital's the same thing. And Nolan has said recently that, listen, these are his exact words, but the idea of coexisting with digital. Digital has its place, sure. Fincher shoots digitally very well. I rewatched Sicario the other day. Deakins mastered that digital. It looked amazing. But in general, the greatest filmmakers of our time are still shooting on film for no other reason than it looks better in their mind. And it also creates a much more immersive experience. So until Spielberg or Nolan or Tarantino or Scorsese or any of these filmmakers, Edgar Wright, Ryan Johnson, J.J. Abrams, until they come out and say, you know what, I'm going to start shooting digitally, I think we need to listen to the fact that these filmmakers understand and know what they're talking about.
But the problem is that you mentioned that all of these filmmakers are finding success shooting this way, but they've got to, at least for someone like Nolan, they've got to obtain success before they have the ability to do it. Nolan, I mean, if Nolan was still making small little independent films. No studio would let him shoot with the IMAX cameras. No studio would let him do the 70mm. So moving forward, once the days of Spielberg and Scorsese and Tarantino are gone, the filmmakers that are finding success have to be filmmakers that share that passion. Because if they don't, then they're not going to push it. Because Warner Brothers is not going to pay $150 million for some no-name guy to go shoot a massive IMAX blockbuster. So we need the guys that are finding success to share that same passion. So hopefully they're learning something from, honest to God, someone like you or someone like Spielberg. And yes, I'm going to put the two of you in the same because you're the only two people on this planet I've heard talk about the artist passionately. I just really hope that the... And, you know, the directors that we're going to be talking about in 20 years that maybe aren't even born yet are raised being taught the importance of something like film.
But, I mean, to me it's interesting because it doesn't have to just to be 70 millimeter. I mean, for example, like Paul Thomas Anderson shot Phantom Thread on 35, right? And the movie is then blown up to 70. Now, he shot The Master on 65 millimeter. You can still shoot 35 and release a film in 70 millimeter. But not just those filmmakers that have big success are doing that. Look at the guys who made Good Time. The Safdie brothers, they shot that movie on 35 millimeter film. La La Land was shot on 35 millimeter film. Now, that was a $20 million budget. But
yeah, but I mean, there's a difference, though, I think, isn't there, between in terms of like how much it costs because of the equipment between shooting a 35 millimeter film and a 70 millimeter film? Like, I mean, it
is 100%.
Like, you've got to go old school.
Well, like, for example, with Tarantino, well, you shoot 65, and then it gets projected on 70. Nolan is shooting IMAX 65, so that's why that's a bit of a different format. So, for example, when Paul Thomas Anderson shoots The Master, he's shooting 65mm film, non-IMAX. Dunkirk was shot 65mm, non-IMAX, and then also IMAX film. So there's two different formats happening there. But generally speaking, Dark Knight's a great example of this, by the way. If you saw Dark Knight in IMAX, you went back and forth between 35mm filmmaking and 65mm IMAX filmmaking. And that jump was massive if you saw it on an IMAX
screen. In fact, if you watch it on Blu-ray, it still does that.
Does the same thing,
but
yeah.
I just saw someone tweeted, if you buy it in 4K, it no longer does that. They like did something to it. They changed the format. It no
really?
Longer jumps. Apparently, I could be wrong. If someone out there has the 4K and I'm wrong, let me know.
I have it.
But I read.
I'll put it in.
Yeah, someone said that if you have like the ones that just came out, the new 4K that just came out, apparently it does not make the jump.
But like 2001, for example, and I know we're gonna move on, but like, and Gabe, I you know saw it as well, and Jake saw it as well.
There's also, I want to talk about this book too.
Yeah, there's. Mine comes in Wednesday. You have to think about, like, filmmakers today, and they're so reliant on CGI technology. And you look at someone like Kubrick, who in 1968 made a film that still holds up today, that looks spectacular. And to me, it just goes into the idea of, are we ruining movies with this tool? And I think the tool is meant to add to what the filmmaker did. So, for example, to me, the best marrying ever of CGI and practical effects was Jurassic Park.
Jurassic Park?
Because Spielberg, at the time, had access to CG. He wanted his dinosaur to run, and he made it happen, but he did what he did in camera first and then enhanced it with CGI technology.
He only used CGI if he had to, if he had no other choice. It was a last resort.
Right. And look at Jurassic World. Right? That movie doesn't hold up because it relied so heavily on CG. Except for the scene where they actually did an animatronic dinosaur when they go up and that dinosaur's dying and they kind of go up and pet it. That felt real.
I also want to bring up Jurassic Park because that's the movie where, since I didn't get to watch 2001, that's the movie where, when you talk about magical moments, when that came back for its 30th anniversary and played theaters, it was like being back when that movie opened. Like, it was still magical to people to experience that on the big screen. And a lot of older people brought younger kids to see it for the first time. But a lot of these people are introduced to this movie on a DVD. And DVDs now, as a family man, will tell you, they're watched in the backs of cars on laptop computers or on small screens. And there's just nothing that compares with being in the dark theater and seeing something on a big screen and the sound. The sound is so important to that experience.
Jake, what was your overall view of what you saw? I mean, like, in regards to, like, there's two different elements I'm asking you for. The experience of seeing it in 70 and then the film itself. Like, what was your, how'd you react to it?
It was pretty astounding to the point where, I mean, I feel like if you can watch a movie that's 50 years old and still ask yourself the question, how did they do that?
Yeah.
Then you've done something right. I mean, I'd argue a majority, even movies that came out that come out today, we know film well enough. We can look at it and go, oh, he probably did this, and then he probably did that, and they probably took a little bit of this, and maybe we don't know the proper nomenclature or the exact order in which they do something, but to watch an entire sequence, and especially knowing the limitations he's working with, it's just simply astounding. And it's just like, I don't understand. And then it goes into the whole debate between myself and Kevin where, like, I don't want to know to a lot of degree. Granted, I'm reading a book about it. And I want to give Gabe, our producer Gabe, a quick shout out because he recommended this book. I'm going to hold it up to for people that are watching live. But for people that are listening days later, it's called Space Odyssey, Stanley Kubrick, Arthur C. Clarke, and the Making of a Masterpiece. It's by Michael Benson. It just came out this year to celebrate its 50th anniversary. And it's just this unbelievably well-researched, well-written history of Arthur C. Clarke and his collaboration with Kubrick and how they sort of became this team and how, like, it's just, and that's where I'm sort of in, I'm in the chapter called pre-production right now. It's unbelievably fascinating, and you know it's good because there's a quote from Tom Hanks on the cover.
Wait, does the book dive into the filmmaking, the aspect of how he shot things?
I haven't gotten there yet.
Okay.
So, I wonder if it does. So it's interesting. Right now, I'm in sort of in the, like, where Stanley Kubrick kind of decided that he wanted to make a science fiction film, and as he famously described it, a pretty good science fiction film, because at the time, science fiction films were trash.
Yeah.
And so he was pointed in the direction of Arthur C. Clarke, who was one of the most well-respected science fiction authors of his time, and he wrote a short story called The Sentinel, which he always, because he always wanted to get into films, and he kind of thought the moment was going to pass him, and he needed to make it happen. And he wrote a short story called The Sentinel, which is sort of the basis for the second sequence of the film, in which when the light hits the monolith and it sort of sets off like a what they refer to as like a fire alarm, because it's this idea that it's buried in the moon, and if we're smart enough to get to the moon and dig it out, then they need to know that these people have reached the point of technology where they can do it. So that's the whole, obviously, if you've never seen 2001, that's the whole concept, is that we, and then we follow to Jupiter where that fire alarm is going.
Can I ask a dumb question? All right, so to this day, I still don't fully understand the film overall. And I think there's a lot of questions that are still unanswered, clearly. I know Kubrick wanted that to be up to your interpretation. I'm sure you guys all agree with that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in the beginning of the film, so the monolith, the scene you're referring to, Jake, with the gentleman on the moon, and they find that monolith buried, that's been buried there for like, what they said, 4 million years? So where are the apes at the beginning of the film? Are they not on Earth?
No, I think that's to me, that's the dawn of man. That's millions of years before.
Mm-hmm. But the monolith goes there. Who buried the monolith in the moon?
You assume the same alien creatures. One of Arthur C. Clarke's famous beliefs, and by no means am I like super smart and know all this, I'm just reading the book, is that, you know, we so many of us look forward to the time in which we're going to be visited by aliens, and what's to say that it hasn't already happened? So this I interpret it as this idea that they came down to Earth, sort of saw what they were working with, that being the dawn of man and sort of the apes that would eventually evolve into us. And so they put this, for lack of a better phrase, a fire alarm on the moon, which was that when we get smart enough and we develop the technology to get to the moon and dig it out, and the sun hits it for the first time in 4 million years, it sends a signal to those alien creatures saying, hey, those apes you just saw, they're now smart enough to get to this point. And that's the point that they wanted to know, that
so
they
is
were
it
able
this-
to get to.
Is it the same monolith that's on the moon that was on Earth?
I
don't understand
don't
that.
So
I
don't know. I couldn't tell you. I mean, who am I to say? I didn't really think of it in that sense.
And then last question. At the end of the film, the baby, what are your thoughts on what that is?
I mean, there's no such thing as definitely 2001. That's Dave Reborn. I don't know. This is the space child. Right. What do you say, Sean?
I'm curious what you guys
think. I
think it's
been years since I've watched it, and I should probably revisit it.
Is it not playing in
yours?
That's right.
No, I have a really old DVD that I could put in.
And not just that, the old Warner Brothers snap case.
Yeah,
I love the old Brothers snap
case. I held it up in the text chain and took a picture of my sad face holding my old DVD. Yeah, I don't even want to watch it. It's not even, I can't justify putting it in the player. I might as well dig up a DVR, VCR out of my closet and try to try to rewatch it.
We assume it's Baby Dave, clearly, because of what just occurred inside that room with the different ages and the different things. But what is the explanation for it? Like, what do you?
I always took it as like the next level of evolution that we don't even have the ability to explain. Right now, where I'm at in the book, they're coming up with the story and they're trying to figure out what the plot. And interesting enough, Stanley Kubrick apparently hated the concept of a plot. He always thought that the plot weighted down a movie because it makes us have to like look forward to what's happening as opposed to appreciating the moment in itself, which is why one of the reasons famously 2001 doesn't really have a plot.
Yeah. That's actually very interesting. And, I didn't even think about that.
So I think
heard he wanted it to be about corn. Isn't that what he said?
No, but that's a great point though, because you're right. 2001 genuinely does not have a plot. I mean, they're really
It has a general idea.
Yeah, the first act of that movie is literally you're just watching the dawn of man occur, and nothing's. It's genuinely just that, and then
it's interesting that what he says about that, the idea being that the dawn of man is whenever they discovered violence, like whenever they discovered murder. So I think which I thought was kind of interesting.
Well, the point being, if this is playing anywhere near you, go see it. If you're even a few cities over, take the train and go find it. Guys cannot recommend it highly enough. Jake has a book that he recommends too. Kevin has one last question.
The famous music that's used in the film, how much of that was previously written prior
to
the movie?
That's old, like 1800s music.
Right. Mm-hmm. Is all of it, though? Every bit of it?
Well, the parts that I'm assuming you're thinking of, the dun-dun.
The Blue Danube? The blue.
The dun, 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 dun. And then what about the music used around the monolith?
The monolith? I thought that was a sound effect.
That horrific, like, it's like a bunch of voices and, like, you know what I'm talking about? Like, I'm curious how, because that music, in our minds, is synonymous with 2001.
Right.
Right.
So I wondered how much of it had been written, that piece you're referring to from the 1800s, but how much of the other stuff was written.
Jake hasn't read that far in the book.
I know that they you can find it. They hired a guy to write the score for 2001, and he put in that the music that you know of as a temporary hold while they were working on the film, and he discovered that it worked so much that he scrapped the score. You can go find it. You can find the score that was written for 2001.
His name was Franz Zimmer, and his son would later go on to become
His son, weirdly enough, John Williams, actually. Yeah. So the music was just supposed to be a temporary hold. He didn't put it in there on purpose. Like a lot of times, if you see a lot of films, they put in music from other movies.
When we did Kubrick Blend, Kevin picked The Shining. Kevin, would you change your pick?
I would now.
Too bad you can't.
No, I would now. After that experience I had.
Enjoy The Shining.
I want to circle back around to Star Wars, to Solo, because I kind of feel like after this weekend we're going to put a lid on it and not talk about it anymore.
Speak for yourself.
So I want to do... Okay, I did. I want to do my spoiler-filled conversation because I have some questions I want Jake to answer. So Gabe is putting in the Facebook feed that we are now going to transition to Solo, a Star Wars story spoilers. If you guys have not seen the film, please stop watching. If you're listening days later and you haven't seen it yet, go see it. Come back later.
Please, God, go see it. Someone please. Go see this movie.
Jake, I want to ask a question because one thing that really bothers me about movies lately is a tease at the end of the film that's supposed to promise more story, and sometimes nothing comes of it. Whether it be Deathstroke meeting Lex Luthor in the Justice League movie, or Tom Cruise launching a dark universe as a mummy. And I want to ask if you think we're going to get a payoff to Darth Maul showing up in Solo, or is that going to become something there where Lucasfilm was just like, well, it was cool when we did that?
I do think we're going to, and I didn't necessarily interpret that scene, and Kevin, feel free to jump in anytime. I didn't interpret that scene as Darth Maul is going to be more involved with Han Solo down the line. To me, it was a little signifier for people that don't watch Clone Wars or don't watch Rebels to, hey, just a heads up, Darth Maul is alive, and so when we use him in other movies that have nothing to do with Solo, don't be surprised when we bring him back. I think it was, honestly, them setting him up to be a part of the Kenobi movie. For people that watch Rebels, they know that Darth Maul and Kenobi end up having this big epic battle back on Tatooine. I wouldn't be surprised if we got a cinematic version of that. In fact, I'd prefer if we got a cinematic version because the fight in Rebels is a little low.
Yeah, it's not as epic as you're selling it.
It's not nearly as cool as you would think it would be. I think they were doing it that way so we start having these conversations. In fact, when I got to work on Monday, all eight people that saw Solo came up to me and they're like, hey, explain to me how Darth Maul is still alive. And I sort of had to say, well, okay, here's the situation. He willed himself back, and now he's got mechanical legs, and it's a whole thing. And I think they did that essentially to set us up for him returning in another person's movie.
Interesting.
Yeah, that scene, to me, didn't have the mind-blowing effect that I think it had a lot of people in the audience when we saw it. I was just like, okay. I mean, like, Darth Maul, to me, was a great part of Phantom Menace, and he was probably my favorite part of Phantom Menace. That's the best John Williams theme that was written in that whole thing, was that fight scene with Darth Maul. What was that called? The Duel of Fates?
Duel of Fates, baby.
So good. Yeah, I mean, the Darth Maul thing, it's an interesting question. I would say that that was there as a setup to include him in future storylines heavily. I mean, I feel like...
But for Solo specifically? Han Solo can never meet him. It doesn't make any sense.
I don't think that Solo would ever physically meet Darth Maul. I think
why can't he meet him?
Because he told Luke and Obi-Wan, I've been from one side of this galaxy to the other, and I've never seen anything that's made me believe in some all-powerful force.
Okay.
Why is Solo cast out of that?
Han Solo tells that in A New Hope, when they board the Millennium Falcon and they're going to Alderaan, tells him that essentially he's never seen anything that's made him believe in Jedis or the Force or, you know.
You're saying Solo said that. I think you said Maul said that. I was like,
No, Solo said that.
Okay.
So why keep putting Darth Maul in your Han Solo movies if he's not going to have anything to do with your main character? And if we know there's not going to be any kind of payoff where he's going to ultimately fight him, it just doesn't make any sense.
Which, by the way, the line you bring up from New Hope when he says that, it adds so much more weight to the moment in Force Awakens when he says it's all true. And that whole arc is amazing. But the my theory on the Darth Maul thing, I if they make two more of these, I think it's going to come down to a point where he's going to have to kill Emilia Clarke. Han Solo is. And I think that's going to be the turning point of his arc, which really kind of turns him into this cynical, very arrogant type of guy who just genuinely is all about himself, in whatever the Han that we know as Ford's version.
Han is going to have to kill Kira?
I think so too. That's what I thought was going to happen in this movie.
Damn,
actually.
That's dark.
She has to die.
Look at him shoot Woody. So when he shoots, we're in spoiler territory now, right?
Yeah.
Oh, we're looking at spoiler territory in the rearview mirror.
When he shoots Woody Harrelson's character, that was a kind of, I guess, in my mind, set a play on the whole shooting Greedo, shoot first thing, which kind of settles the whole debate there, thankfully. But the concept of him kind of going to that side and him telling Kira, I'm a bad guy, even though we know he doesn't really feel that way, or we don't think he's a bad guy at that moment. I don't think I've ever thought of Han as a bad person. But I think that he gets eventually so jaded by the reality of what happens with the Kira situation, that's kind of the person that we know Han to be. And Jake has a great theory or idea that I think would be brilliant if they actually have him walking into the cantina at the end of the third Solo, theoretically, and then we walk in and that's the Ford we know and the Solo we know.
I don't think we get another Solo movie.
You made a good point though. I think it was on your Twitter I read this somewhere that you turn these three films into individualized characters that revolve around Solo.
Handing off the baton of the story.
Yeah, right, so Jake, talk about that, because we've had this in the text chain too, but lay that out, how you would, instead of doing a traditional Han Solo sequel, you'd rather they go in this direction.
Right. I mean, and right now there are a lot of sort of, spinning plates right now in terms of the Solo characters they're talking about doing. Lando's been talked about, Kenobi's been talked about, and at this point now, Boba Fett's been talked about. I think if you're going to make a trilogy, if you're going to make an overarching story, have a different character be the focus of each film. So we got the Solo one, and have a loose thread connect Solo to potentially Boba Fett and have him carry the next chapter of that story. And then have, when Boba Fett ends, have it either Lando or Kenobi. and have him carry and have it be one overarching story that has consequences on all the characters, but have the focus of each one be different.
So now let me ask a question.
I love that idea. I really
do. I
do
too. Now, because they tease Jabba at the end of Solo, where Han says there's a gangster on Tatooine that has a mission, Do you think that they have that plan?
The movie
if Boba
ends
Fett's
with
next,
the,
then yes.
Yeah, the movie ends with the idea, clearly. And the movie ends with the idea that there is going to be more. I mean, clearly they have, the end of the film positions the film to move on.
Right.
And there's clearly story that hasn't been told. And I think the Boba Fett idea is, well, Boba Fett shows up, what, in Empire for the first time, right?
No, we don't Boba Fett for the first time showed up in the holiday special.
Okay, but in the original trilogy, he's in
Empire.
Yeah,
he showed
first.
Up in Empire. Yeah.
So
because there's a great Han Solo story where like he had to smuggle drugs. The whole reason Boba Fett's coming after him, the whole reason Jabba's coming after him, is because Han Solo was essentially a drug smuggler and then ran into the Empire and had to dump the drugs and then lost Jabba a ton of money. And that's the job that he's going to do.
But the line you're referring to from New Hope when he says, "I've been across the galaxy and I haven't seen anything that would make me believe in the Force," could he be lying? Could he be just not thinking about, or maybe he blocked that aspect out? I mean, you never know.
I think if you start doing that, you run into a really, because then you can make the argument, then what's the point that we believe any of these characters then? Like, if you could just come back and rewrite it as, oh, he was lying, then.
So,
then,
but if Han has to kill Kira, so let's say that theory plays out. I mean, to me, that's the most.
I'm not on board with that. I think that's
dark. Oh, I love it. Oh,
I think that's a very strong storyline. Yeah. Because it's something that's going to make him the Han that we know. Yeah. I genuinely think it's going to shut him off emotionally, which is why, and actually I think it'll add to the whole idea of his and Leia's romance and that idea of him trying to finally latch on to somebody again, but unwillingly.
It'll add a significance to it. It'll add a weight 100%. To it other than just, you know, oh, because these days I feel like we kind of just put Han and Leia together, Han and Leia, because that's the way it's always been. But when you write it as like, he had to get over the fact that he killed his freaking girlfriend,
it adds
more of a significance and more of a weight to his relationship with Leia. Kevin,
it would actually change emotionally how I feel about Empire, I think. Only because of the idea of thinking of him unwillingly falling for somebody. I guess you start to see him fall for her slightly in New Hope, slightly. Because him and Luke are doing that whole bit about, like, you know, she likes me, she's like, whatever. But I think it would be a lot more, as Jake said too, emotionally weighted on us as an audience member. It would make more sense why he's so arrogant and so against anybody letting himself. I think he has to kill Kira. I think that has to happen. Because why else has he become that guy? We see it a little bit in this movie. And the Woody scene really is kind of a jump for him, clearly. Right. But he doesn't hesitate.
How much more do we really get of him, though? I mean, like, if we get the Boba Fett movie, and in theory, the Boba Fett movie picks up with Han, like, arriving into Jabba's palace, and then Boba Fett takes it from there, I mean, how much is Han really involved with that movie?
Yeah. Well, I think Lando's, if they do it as you're saying, if they go Boba Fett second, then they go, I think they go Lando third, in my opinion, if they do it. Then the Lando aspect obviously brings Han back in very heavily, clearly. So I wonder.
I'd argue the box office has convinced them not to do that.
But I wonder, I mean, it's a very interesting thing, but are they going to examine it and go, okay, we're leaving it in May, or leaving it in December, and we're going to leave it up? Because here's my problem with Solo, and you guys can disagree with me all you want. The problem with that film was the script. I mean, I genuinely don't think it's a good script. I think it's a very bad script. And I think there is great performances.
You think it's a very bad script?
I'll tell you why. There was a lot of things I didn't like about the script. The reason I like Solo, I think the movie works. It's fun. It's passable. It's fine. To me, it works because of Alden, because he's amazing in the role. Amelia's amazing. Woody's amazing. Everybody on camera, Lando, everybody, Glover, awesome performances. It's a very bad script. And I say that because, well, specifically the two scenes, you know, I'm talking about the name scene. Now that we're in spoiler territory, I cringe every time I think about the Han Solo name scene.
But you're talking about 1/8 of a script page.
But let me get to other things about that script. I mean, first of all, it's a very, very poorly paced movie. It is dragging in the middle slightly. And in the end, it just kept going and going and going. Like, the Kessel Run is so cinematic and intense, and then it just kind of comes to a halt, and then you have the Enfys character coming in, and that to me was interesting, the whole switcheroo with Bettany and Woody, that was cool. But I mean, it felt chunky, and it just felt like it was not paced
well.
So
do you think that they rush these movies into production? Do you think that they say, we have to deliver on this, and they don't have the scripts in place?
Listen, I don't know for sure what happened on that set, but I would imagine, if I was guessing, and I can only guess, that Miller and Lord reportedly went off script. That's what we've heard, right?
They shot the script, and then they had their actors shoot other takes in an effort to potentially be more funny, or because they rely heavily on improv in the films that they did prior to this.
Like, there's a bit in the movie that I thought was screenwriting 101, and it just shouted at me, like, this guy is trying to, or John and Lawrence Kasdan. There's a bit where in the middle of the film, Emilia Clarke's character says to Han, you know, when I thought about you while you were gone, I did something, right? And then at the end of the movie, it's like that classic callback to the line. It's like, as he's walking out the door, I smiled. That's what I thought about. I just don't like when a screenplay calls attention to itself, and it's screaming to me that, and I know these are very minor things, but they really took me out of the movie. They really did. I mean, I don't know.
I'm very much a believer that you can make a bad movie with a good script, but you can't make a good movie with a bad script. I have a hard time believing that it's a good movie, but a bad script, because I just don't think one can turn into the other.
I just don't think it's a good script. I just genuinely found it to be very, very middle-of-the-road writing. Like, nothing in the thing jumped off the screen for me. It was always just passable, and it worked, and it was entertaining at times, but it just felt dry and very, I don't know, it just felt very blah to me. I don't know where you guys are at on that, but I don't know if Gabe saw it or Sean saw it, but I
liked it. I thought it was fun. I think of all the commentary that's being thrown out about Solo, the one that rings the most true to me, and then we'll move on to Star Wars Blend after this because I want to give us time to talk about those, is that it felt like a routine summer blockbuster movie, and a Star Wars movie, whether fair or not, should be elevated to a level where it's more special than that. And I think that that's true. And I think that, but I think that's a short-term problem. Because I think when December 2019 rolls around, Episode 9 is going to feel like the event that a Star Wars movie should feel like. So maybe it's timing. Maybe it's the subject matter. I wasn't super excited for a Han Solo movie, but if it were more fun, I would have been way on board.
I just genuinely think there's a massive, massive drop in quality from Force Awakens to Solo. And having seen Force Awakens, which is one of my favorite Star Wars movies, it is hard not to think about the quality that Disney was putting into that movie compared to what we saw on screen with Solo. Solo, also cinematography-wise, it's a gorgeous film, but it feels glossy, and it's shot digitally.
I feel like that the episodes are always sort of meant to be. To me, the stories were always supposed to be like sort of the equivalent of like the independent films of Star Wars, as opposed to the episodes were always these more grand epic adventures. Though by definition, the whole story was just supposed to be these small little tiny pockets of fun, little side story, like a little fun.
You know what? Prior to this, we never had these little one-offs. It was always just the chapters of the trilogy that we were getting. This is a new thing for Star Wars. And maybe there's an essence of training the audience.
But Rogue One worked. Rogue One is not a film that I loved, but looking back at Rogue One...
Yeah, but I mean, that's cheating, though, because that's basically like, you know, if A New Hope is you know, episode 4, then Rogue One is like episode 3.9. It's basically an episode.
But Rogue One to me... Yeah. But nothing in Solo blew me away.
Right.
Something in Rogue One blew my mind, and that was the last 30 minutes. I was reading an interview recently, I interviewed a gentleman recently. What was the Burt Reynolds movie that came out recently where he was like the
Smokey
last...
Smokey and the Bandit.
No, the last star. He was like, it was about the idea of an actor losing his A-list ability throughout the years and kind of looking back on his career. I can't remember the name of the film off the top of my head, but the filmmaker who made that movie.
I think it was called The Last Star or something like that.
He made a great point. He goes, you can win an audience completely in the last act. Your movie can be crap the first two acts, and you can literally win your audience in the third act. That's what Rogue One did. Rogue
One. I think people come out of the movie talking about the last thing they saw.
Oh, yeah. Rogue One. And again, I don't agree that that makes a good movie. I actually think that that's a bad thing if like the third act is great and everything else is just mediocre and you walk out on a high because of the third act being so good. And that kind of sways people's opinions because they don't really, they think back to the first two acts of the movie and they go, the third act was really cool though. But
yeah.
But Rogue One blew my mind in the third act. I think it did everybody. I mean, it was the best Vader scene in the history of Star Wars. No question.
There is nothing in Solo that's better than the last act of Rogue One.
Nothing.
I'll give you that. But I'd argue that a majority of Solo is better than the first two acts of Rogue One.
Yeah. That might be true. All right, so we're nitpicking now. Let's get to our top three. The producer Gabe sort of said that we should do this week's hashtag Star Wars blend is all of us just give our three, our top three. Each of us go one at a time instead of doing like, here's all of our number ones, here's all of our number twos. Because what we think is that the number three in all of our lists is going to be the conversation starter. So I want to start with Kevin because he seems like he has a pretty interesting list. And so, Kevin, give your three, one, two, and three. We'll quickly comment on them. And then Jake will go and then I'll go. And then we'll just sort of see where we're at after that.
It's interesting because I probably switch this in my mind daily or weekly. So at the moment I'm feeling this way. Next week I'll feel a different way. But these three films are always in my mind in the contention of the best Star Wars three, no question. It's just okay. Where I order them. Empire clearly is number one. I mean, I don't think anybody is going to go against that. Okay. I think number two is The Force Awakens, and I think it's interesting because. And I think it's that because of the criticism of it being so similar to New Hope. I think it's a better version of New Hope, oddly enough. I know. You guys can crush me all you want.
You can't have I really one do. Without the other. All right, so what is...
I don't even care what three is anymore.
I kind of care what three is.
Three's a New Hope.
Three is New Hope?
Yeah. I don't see why this is that controversial. I don't think this is that controversial. If I was being controversial, Last Jedi would be number one. And I've seen people have that on their list.
All right, but I just think you can't have number two without number three.
You can't have Empire without number one. So how do you put New Hope first? That goes against what you're saying.
Do you think...
Wait. What do you...
No, you're right. You're right. I understand your point. But let me ask a question. I want to ask a question between Force Awakens and New Hope.
It's so fun.
Is it the production value? Is that what you mean? Production value, it's better made?
I mean, I think production value, I think...
The pacing?
Definitely pacing.
Right.
I just
characters?
Find...
You like the characters in Force Awakens more than...
I'll tell you why I think Force Awakens is a better film than New Hope. It all comes down to the Han's death scene. I think that's, in my opinion, the most emotion I've ever felt in a Star Wars movie. Genuinely just destroyed me, and I think it's a beautifully directed scene. I think it's honestly my favorite directed scene in the whole Star Wars. I don't know. I got to think about that for a second.
This is one of those, if you're not watching the show live...
You guys could kill me all you want.
No, but I will say, I'll say this. The first time I saw New Hope, and so I was, I'm older than you guys are. The Obi-Wan death was stunning. The Obi-Wan death had the same emotional impact that that Han's death had. Because at that point, we just weren't used to our films killing off our heroes. We hadn't seen it that often, and it was really, it grabbed audiences by the throat, and it was stunning.
Honestly, for me, I think the most emotional moment in all of Star Wars is from a movie that's not even in my top three. It's the scene
on the sand conversation.
Yes, sand. in Revenge of the Sith, Mustafar, the like, I hate you, you were my brother, you were supposed to be the chosen. To me, that's the one. Scene. Because that reminds you, to me, that does two things. It makes you look at stuff that came before and stuff that came after differently. It makes you look at their relationship from the first two movies, and then makes you realize. It adds to the killing scene where Vader kills Obi-Wan. Just this, like, they were brothers. They were best friends. They were, and that's the That's the scene that gets me.
When it all comes down to it, J.J. Abrams is a better filmmaker than George Lucas. And that's really what it comes down to. And I think
that
The Force Awakens is a better film. And now here's the question. Are we ranking these as favorites or best?
Best. We're ranking best. The three best.
So I think The Force Awakens is a better film than The New Hope. Now, A New Hope may be a favorite over Force Awakens. But remember, you guys have to be choosing on quality here. Best film
I'm choosing on quality.
And Jake, New Hope is not a better film than Force Awakens as a quality type of movie, in my opinion.
Jake, go ahead.
Number one's Empire.
Yes.
My number two is A New Hope.
Okay.
And the number three best Star Wars film based on quality is The Return of the Jedi.
Oh.
I mean, say what you want to about the new films. And knock Return of the Jedi. Oh, wait. We're not getting into it yet, are we?
You can. Yeah, you can. No. That's fine.
Go.
I think the Jabba's Palace sequence and the Skarlak is all-time classic Star Wars.
Agreed.
I think Endor, say what you want to about Ewoks. I mean, every Star Wars movie has aspects that I would sort of pluck out.
Pretty cringy.
I think that planet is incredibly creative. Yeah. And I'd argue the blend of the three battle sequences at the end between father and son in space trying to destroy Death Star 2 and the Battle of Endor are all beautifully woven to, in my opinion, be probably the best action sequence of all the Star Wars movies, because you're blending battles at three different levels. Big, intergalactic, massive. This idea of small natives versus a massive corporation, and then this idea of small personal father-son. The fact that they blend all of those together, it's just absolutely incredible. I think Luke aboard the Death Star wearing all the black with the green lightsaber, just beautifully filmed. I think it's just, you know, Return of the Jedi gives us stuff we hadn't seen before and stuff we haven't seen since.
I think Return of the Jedi is the Temple of Doom of Star Wars. I say that because Temple of Doom and Return of the Jedi have the best opening scene out of the entire out of the main three films. Mm-hmm. Temple of Doom's opening is so freaking amazing, and then the opening of Return of the Jedi is honestly the best opening of any Star Wars movie. It is unbelievably well done. So it's hard. I love Return of the Jedi. I don't love the third act as much as you do.
And see, I think the third act is fantastic.
But then I gotta say one thing before we move on to Sean. Jake's the biggest Star Wars fan I've ever met in my life. So I love Star Wars. Star Wars posters all over my house. My wife and I love Star Wars, but I'm not in it as much as Jake as.
And that's fair. I snapped at someone on Twitter.
Snoped.
This morning, because I'm very much, and I sort of had to say this a lot over the weekend because of Solo, that especially when it comes to Star Wars movies, opinions are just opinions. I know we're giving Kevin a hard time, and it's funny because I don't comprehend his ranking, and I have a hard time sort of seeing it. But by no means am I trying to imply that I am right and he is wrong, because opinions are by definition just that.
But there is an aspect to someone of your level of fandom for Star Wars.
Because I'd argue you're a bigger Deadpool fan than I am, but I have the capacity within myself to say that I didn't like Deadpool 2 more than Deadpool 1, and I don't think my opinion is any less important because I like it less than other people.
I agree, but my point is, I think you're more invested in the Star Wars universe than I am in regards to the number of times you've seen the films and things like that. I think that your opinion on the ranking is probably more in tune with what Star Wars fans feel than somebody who's a fan, but not as an obsessive fan in regards to somebody who's like really in tune with every aspect of the things that are in the canon and not in the movie. So that's why I just want to make sure the listeners out there understand where I'm coming from, that I'm not on the same level of fandom as Jake is in regards to Star Wars.
But also, what is the general fan consensus on Return of the Jedi? I'm not actually I mean, is that something like,
I don't know.
Are the three that I gave like the common three, or like what?
I think Return of the Jedi doesn't get enough credit for sticking the landing in the way that we've seen too many trilogies fumble in the third chapter, and that one brings really satisfying conclusion to a storyline, and I think that that's a lot harder to do than people realize. Yeah. And so, yeah, I would give Return of the Jedi, while I think it's just dated, it feels like an old movie, whereas Empire and New Hope to me sort of transcend the time that they were made.
That's
they
fair.
Still, you could put them on now and it's still pretty timeless. I can't watch Return of the Jedi and those speeder bikes on Endor, which probably was super exciting back in the day. And it was, I had Trapper Keepers that had like Jungle Luke and Leia on them, and it was amazing. But now if you go back and watch it, it's like the worst special effect. It's like, I can't watch any conversation of actors in a car because all I see is the screen that's wrapped around.
Unless it's a Quentin Tarantino movie.
Why? Does he actually do cars?
He does it. Like when he does the car scenes and he does
Kill
like
Bill.
The taxi scene in Pulp Fiction.
Pulp Fiction. That's all screen. And I think he actually wants it to look like that. I mean, like,
he did that on purpose. Yeah.
The worst one to me, and Terminator 2 is one of my favorite films of all time. The worst one to me is the screenshot they have where it's Arnold, Linda Hamilton, and John Connor all in the car after Robert Patrick chases them out of the building. And that whole sequence it just looks really bad. Like the blue, you can tell they're on a stage. Yeah.
All right. Well, here's my list really fast. Empire 1. So we all have
Empire 1. Can I guess where you're going to go?
Yeah, sure. Of course.
You're going to go Empire, New Hope, Force Awakens.
Correct. Yeah, correct.
Interesting.
And I'll use my time because you guys have made amazing points about each of those. Empire has to be number one. And in the debate between New Hope and Force Awakens, I just can't not give credit to the one that started it all. Like, I have to give, and I don't think that it has, there's not a moment in it at all. That movie, to me, is for what it's supposed to be, flawlessly put together. There isn't a moment where I'm like, oh, this scene doesn't matter, and let's skip past. Like, all of the scenes matter. They all build toward the conclusion. Like, them infiltrating the Death Star and Luke shooting the laser through the blast and all of that stuff, for what it is, telling that story is amazing. It's all perfect to it. JJ is, to me, the closest person to rekindle the magic of going to see a Star Wars movie. And I feel like all the movies since then have chased it. But now, because of the existence of all the new films, we're chasing after different levels of what a Star Wars movie should be. Now we have gritty, surface-level Star Wars movies. And now we have Pie in the Sky, Rian Johnson, Star Wars movies, and everybody's sort of debating which one they like more. But to me, JJ's essence of just going to a Star Wars movie is strapping yourself into that roller coaster and just riding the ride. And yes, it felt like an echo of New Hope, because it is. I mean, like, it's just so many beats are similar to what New Hope is. But I think that's what JJ does really well. I think that he takes something that's really familiar to you and he updates it and puts his own spin on it, and it looks great, and it's funny in all the places I want it to be funny.
It's perfectly balanced.
It's beautifully cast. Like, all of it's just great. Force Awakens is great.
Who is the odd man out here, then? Am I the odd man out? Because you two essentially chose the same three movies.
You're the odd man out.
Yeah.
But what I will say is, I am a lot closer to putting Last Jedi at number three than you guys are.
Whoa.
And if Force Awakens didn't exist...
Last Jedi?
The four new movies to me rank Force Awakens, Last Jedi, Solo, Rogue One. So
no way.
If Force Awakens didn't exist, Last Jedi to me is above all the prequels and above Return of the Jedi. Because it's great. It's actually great. I really like what Rian did, and it's a beautiful film. If you're arguing the quality of a film, it is a beautiful film.
It's a gorgeous movie. It just completely understands that it's a movie, and it completely just laughs at the audience. That's how I felt about that movie.
I will say this,
The Force Awakens, I just think Kylo is such an interesting character. I think he's one of the best characters ever written in the Star Wars universe, and I think that he's so interestingly complicated, and I think... Oh my god! I think that determines what
happens with him in nine.
Well, we're going to run out of time. But I have to say that there are a lot of really interesting mysteries raised by Force Awakens that aren't important anymore.
I know.
I still want to know how Maz got Luke Skywalker or Luke's lightsaber.
She
says, like, "Oh, it's a story for another time." Now's the time.
I don't know who Rey's parents really are. I don't believe that Rey's parents are not anybody.
They're somebody.
They have to be somebody.
Her great grandfather's Kenobi. That's a great theory. by the way. Why does she have a British accent? Why is her accent British and John's is American? And it doesn't make any sense. There was a choice deliberately made there for those actors to have the accents they do. And there's
I do think you're overthinking that a little bit.
No. Why? Tell me why John Boyega has an American accent and Ray has a British accent. Tell me why.
I don't know.
What was the choice? They're both British actors.
That's a great question. And if any of us get JJ in the next year, please ask him that.
There's
you can
reason.
Answer that without giving away a spoiler. That's not a spoiler. Well, maybe it is a spoiler, actually.
I asked that Daisy Ridley that question, but she said she just has... she just says that she just... I don't remember what she said to me, honestly, but it's an interesting question that I think is...
Peterson W. Hill. It was very fun to see our listeners play along with this one. People started chiming in pretty early. And Peterson W. Hill has Last Jedi number one, Empire second, and Rogue One third. And then I got to point out one of our listeners, Vandy Price, who is all over the board. He has Revenge of the Sith as four, and Rogue One at five, and then Last Jedi at six.
I know somebody who thinks Sith is the greatest Star Wars movie ever made.
That's crazy talk.
I genuinely know somebody who actually thinks that.
The fight between Yoda and Palpatine, like, is so CGI disgusting that, like, no one could actually say this. That, like, while watching it, like, yeah, this is the best. This is peak Star Wars. It's horrifying.
Some people just want to see the world burn.
Oh, God. All right, next week. Next week I was going to do Howard Blend, because I kind of thought we're going to have to do Ron Howard eventually. And it's tied to Solo, and let's do him now, but I'm changing gears. I so much enjoyed our conversation of Kubrick and 2001 and classic film, that I want your opinions for next week when we do hashtag Hitchcock Blend.
Oh my God.
And I really want us to get super nerdy, because we only have movies like Adrift and something else.
Hey, I liked Adrift.
Well, it's fine. And by next week, we can talk about Hereditary also. But I think a chunk of next week is going to be Hitchcock Blend. We're going to dedicate a chunk of time to that, because I think that's going to be a lot of fun.
He's staring at me right now.
Yeah. Next week, you start using on Twitter right now, hashtag Hitchcock Blend. You can let us know your picks via email, realblend@cinemablend.com. We have an email address. We have a Twitter account, @realblend. And then we all have individual accounts. Jake, what is your individual Twitter account?
Mine is Jake's Takes awaits Kevin's smartass comment to this.
Kevin, yours is?
I'm going to go with...
you have to pre-write these. That's the thing.
All right. @Return of the King is the best Lord of the Rings film.
Oh, God. Oh, no, it's not. Geez.
That is certainly available.
Imagine. Sean, that was my actual Twitter.
That's taken. Dang it. Someone has this one. If you were watching on Facebook, thank you so much for tuning in. If you are listening to us on iTunes or any of the podcast apps, please leave us a review and give us a little star rating. We'll be back next week, where we're going to discuss whatever the new news comes up. And as I said, we're going to play hashtag Hitchcock Blend, which I'm super excited for. So guys, thank you so much for tuning in. We will see you
Dunkirk
next week.
Dunkirk. Dunkirk. Dunkirk.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hurry into Menards and save big money. Stock up on water softener Salt for softer skin and cleaner clothes. Diamond Crystal is the perfect choice of salt to minimize water softener tank residue. It helps your soaps and detergents clean better while increasing the life of your appliances and plumbing. Save big on Diamond Crystal products at Menards. And don't forget to check out the flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big.